Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ever since Sue Miller wrote her luminous debut novel, The Good Mother, she's taken readers into the souls of her fictional characters and made them so real, so flawed, so deeply human, that they have staying power and poignancy long after the last pages of her books have been turned. In Miller's haunting novel, While I Was Gone, the emotionally closed and not very nice Jo Becker struggles to reconcile her past. In Family Pictures, she paints an intimate portrait of how a sick child can irrevocably change family relationships. Her new book takes on the all-too-real. In The Story of My Father, Sue Miller shares the drama, the guilt, the chaos of caring for her own father who was stricken with Alzheimer's disease. We always find ourselves deficient in devotion, she writes. Did you visit once a week? You might have visited twice. Oh, you visited daily, but perhaps he would have done better if you'd kept him at home. In the end, all those judgments, those self-judgments, are pointless. This disease is inexorable, cruel. It scoffs at everything, she writes. Is this a road you know? Is Sue Miller telling the story of your father, your mother, your spouse? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio now is the acclaimed novelist and teller of human truth, Sue Miller. Her new book is The Story of My Father, a memoir. Good evening and welcome, Sue Miller.
Thanks. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. Gosh, you have such a marvelous way with all the details of human life and the kind of resonance of the smallest twitches and shared glances and all the rest. And then suddenly your novelist power is put to work telling a story that's extraordinarily personal, right in the middle of your family, the story of a parent, of a father coming apart, and the twinning of your talent in that story I found very powerful. Sue Miller, tell us, before we get to Alzheimer's, give us a picture of your father, your relationship with him before all this came at him.
He was in some ways a man who's difficult to describe, just because he was very quiet, very modest. He had a sort of sweetness to him. He also was in a very old-fashioned way, a Christian gentleman. He was a deep believer, and I think that colored every aspect of his life. And it sort of made him honor everyone very equally, so that he was one of the world's best listeners to me, but also to everyone else. There was a sense of sort of egalitarian abstractedness about my father. In his very sweetness, he was equally there for everybody. And so, in a certain way, for a child of his, equally absent for me in an odd way.
Because he was there for everyone, because he listened to whatever came to him.
Truly. And he was a tremendously generous, interested, and yet disinterested person. I mean, without a guiding interest in it, he would just hear you. And I think that in many ways, in writing this book, I struggled with both everything that was wonderful about him as a father in that regard and everything that was difficult about him as a father in that regard.
Did Alzheimer's ultimately magnify what was wonderful and what was difficult equally, or does it not get weighted that way?
I think it didn't weight that way, but for me, I discovered at a certain point in thinking about the illness and in thinking about my father as I wrote this book that I was suddenly very aware of that sense of absence. I was aware of Alzheimer's disease as a sort of repetition of loss for me. But I think in terms of what it exposed about him, it didn't. I mean, he was sort of who he was. And it did kind of, in a certain sense, I think, distill who he was. But it didn't particularly point to that. It pointed to a kind of graciousness and sweetness and carefulness. Mm. I mean, I write in the book that sometimes, because he couldn't think of the exact words for it, to say, you're welcome,
would take him a minute, two minutes, three minutes to try and get around to the same thought.
He so wished to continue to be gracious. He
to be that gracious gentleman.
The exact words.
Ironically, in some way, he was an historian.
Entirely ironically, in terms of this disease, he was a church historian primarily, but he was deeply interested in history of all kinds. And I think I also say in the book, ironically, because of who he was, because he was also personally not very interested in his own history, so that one had a sense of a lack of interest in self. And we had to sort of pry details out of him about his own childhood, mm-hmm. about his past. He was, as I say, sort of an abstract figure in a certain way.
And I guess it's also important to say, because this disease, once it arrives, it kind of touches everything. The book, in some sense, reads as much a book about your mother as your father. Tell us about her.
Well, they were opposites, that simply put. She was a very flamboyant and egocentric person, always on center stage, and in some ways very difficult. She didn't much like little children because little children don't make a good audience for such a person. She was wonderful to us when we were older because then there was a sort of equal exchange and we could be very admiring and so forth. But she and my father were really, really polar opposites. And I think in some ways, as I say in the book, there are ways in which I think she masked the disease from us by her enormously important presence and energetic presence. I think my father may have been a little bit symptomatic even before she died. Mm-hmm. She died when she was 60 and he was almost 65. Mm. And I think she just, because of this sort of sense of activity around her, because one didn't pay a lot of attention to him when she was around, I think we didn't really notice him. And I think she also enormously kept him going. I mean, she was just on him all the time.
Do you think there was a way in which she may have even known that she was covering or supplementing your father somehow, or was she oblivious?
That I don't think. I think she did have a sense of his. The year that she died, they were here in, I was living in Cambridge and they were living near me. And he was turning to scholarly work for the first time in quite a while. He'd been a dean at Princeton Theological Seminary for a while. And she said to me at one point that, you know, being dean had just ruined my father for his scholarly life. And I couldn't tell exactly whether this was just melodrama. You never could tell. But it occurred to me afterwards, after he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's some years later, that she may have been describing, without knowing it, the sort of beginnings of his inability to truly focus in a scholarly way on things. She did notice that, but she ascribed it to the thing she was most jealous of.
To the deanship.
Yeah, the thing which took him away from her so enormously. Mm.
Alzheimer's hits something like 1 in 10 people over 65. I read 4 or 5 million Americans have it, and 14 million may have it by the middle of this century. Nearly half of those over 85. So it touches many, many people. Yeah. I'm sure you found this in talking about it. You raise it, and right away, someone next door, down the street, around the block, the cousin, someone's own father, mother, or spouse has it. How did it – describe how it first showed up in your life.
Well, there had been some signs before, I must say, but the dramatic event which signaled it for all of us, for my family, was that I got a call early one morning in June of 1986 – from the police in Western Massachusetts, I can't remember the name of the town now even, but saying they had my father. And my husband woke me up to tell me this. I was just so disoriented and confused. Yeah. The police had my father. And it was so incongruous in terms of who he was and why it should have been. I couldn't imagine it. But they did say, I got on the phone, they said a man who claimed to be my father was in their custody because he'd been meandering around Western Massachusetts in the middle of the night, knocking on doors and really sort of frightening people. He seemed so disoriented. I drove out to Western Massachusetts and picked him up at the police station. And he was very tired and very confused. He'd had a
disheveled, hadn't bathed.
He looked horrible. And it turned out he hadn't eaten, he hadn't slept in maybe even 24 hours. He had delivered some furniture up to his summer house and tried to do this on his own. And He had a van that the police couldn't find. I think they didn't believe in the van, its existence. And we drove off, the police saying, well, they would report to me when they found it. And I began to talk to my father about what he was doing and how he'd turned up there and in this unlikely place. And he told me about going up to New Hampshire with his worldly goods to put them into his summer house. And then he began to speak of the way the stop signs had turned into people as he drove along.
And at first you wanted to hear it as some kind of metaphor or some kind of gee whiz, I was so tired or hungry last night that, but it wasn't just that.
No. I mean, I sort of said, oh, you mean they look like people? No, he said, no, they were people. They had arms and legs. And he spoke to them. And I just couldn't listen anymore. I just thought, okay, well, we'll get him home. We'll feed him again. I'll get him to bed. And then when he woke up, he seemed all right for a little while, and then he began to again have these delusions. And then in essence, I was able to sort of argue him out of them and bring him back, I think probably because he'd rested enough.
How old was he at this point?
At that point, he was 71.
How long did he live after you learned that he had his Alzheimer's?
He was 76 when he died. Mm-hmm. So he lived 5 years after his diagnosis.
Which is a little less than average as far as I understand.
Usually people live the average is about 10 years after diagnosis. But my father got ill with something that he couldn't describe or report. And so he died of that illness. I mean, usually people with Alzheimer's disease die of something else. And sometimes it is an illness that they can't talk about and can't describe the symptoms of and that people miss. And that's what happened with us.
Sue Miller, in The Good Mother and such a string after you've written so many very popular and highly acclaimed novels, what was it like for you to turn around to these intimate details of your own personal life and relationship with a father and turn that into your work, into a book?
It was just incredibly difficult. It's taken me 10 years to produce this book. I started writing in 1992, and I stopped. I mean, I did other work in between. But I was always thinking, oh, this is it. I have to come back to it. I mean, it was the thing which I wanted to finish. And I think a lot of it was simply not having written nonfiction before and not having stepped forward before as truly the first-person narrator. I mean, sometimes I used the first person, but it was... And it might have been close enough to who I was, but it wasn't me. It was never me. It was never I.
Right.
And this time the I was I. And I discovered that I wasn't entirely comfortable with that. I also discovered I didn't truly know how to write nonfiction. I didn't know how to find the center of it. I didn't know how to figure out what was important in it. And it was really a long process of distilling and writing and discarding that led me to the final version of this book.
And I found it interesting. You write that your father had, in a way, been instrumental in you becoming a writer in the first place. You write that you had sought refuge in my father's calm and that it may be part of why you now write fiction, why you choose to move around imaginatively in other invented people's joys and agonies. And now here you were in his own, in your own.
Mm-hmm. It was really hard to deal with what was real. I mean, when you're moving in an imaginary world, you can make happen what you need to have happen. You can, the narrative arc is under your control entirely. And in this book, I obviously had to make myself as a writer subservient to what had actually happened while also trying to make some kind of narrative arc in the book.
How do you describe to people, you know, in a minute, what Alzheimer's is like?
Well, that is the problem. I mean, and I sort of, in this book, I think I come at it in this way, and then I come at it in another way. All the while, I'm sort of trying to knit together ideas that I had about the illness and ideas that I had about my father having the illness. But I do sort of take a series of tacks, I think, and then at the very end, try in the last few chapters to sort of weave all of those together and make some sort of sense for the reader of the experience he's had and therefore the experience I had in sort of in constructing this book. And I hope that's successful, but it's not a very predictably organized narrative, I think.
And I guess it couldn't be for anyone, but part of your point in writing it is to share that experience with others who may be going through it, may one day go through it.
Exactly.
We're talking this hour with Sue Miller, novelist and best-selling author of The Good Mother, about Alzheimer's and the story of her father. Her new book is The Story of My Father, a memoir. You can join the conversation. Have you dealt with the Alzheimer's demise of a loved one? Have you felt that unique despair at a mind, not a body, coming apart? Can you imagine a father, a mother, a beloved spouse becoming someone you hardly know and who doesn't know you? You can join us tonight. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Sue Miller, novelist and best-selling author of The Good Mother, about Alzheimer's and the story of her father. She's written a new book. It's called The Story of My Father, a memoir. It describes her father's descent into Alzheimer's and the long path that that took him and his family and his novelist daughter on. You can join the conversation. Have you dealt with the Alzheimer's demise of a loved one? Do you hear your story in Sue Miller's words? What's the hardest blow to bear in Alzheimer's? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Sue, I wish you'd read us just a bit from the book here. Maybe there's a passage on 83 where your father is now in a special care home. You visit.
Yeah, and this connects to this notion of what's the greatest loss, I think, in Alzheimer's. And one loss that I didn't have to experience was his not knowing me, which I think must be very hard. He did know me. He knew the rest of the family.
All the way through.
All the way through. And this passage sort of describes a moment of recognition very late in the game for him. He never didn't know me, I said proudly. Up to the end, he knew me. Technically, importantly, this was true. Even the last time I visited him, when he was conscious, he recognized me at first. When I came into his room, he was standing by his crib bed, gripping its rails with white-knuckled intensity and staring fixedly at something he was seeing on his blanket. He was slightly bent at this point, a gentle Parkinsonian curve to his back. I spoke to him, but he didn't seem to hear me. I went over and touched him. I swung my head just under his face and looked up at him, smiling. "Hi, Dad," I said. He started. "Why, Susie," he said, calling me by my little girl name. And it seemed that he was actually seeing me as a little girl in that moment. His smile was so delighted, his voice so light and glad. He knew me. I clung to that, to those happy moments at the start of each visit. Before I denied what he knew to be true, before I failed to respond humanely to what he reported as calamity, before I told him what I could not or would not do for him today, take him to the doctor, find his books, get his car back, before he said, as he did at least every other time I got up to leave, "Say, are you driving? I was wondering if maybe you could give me a lift home."
And there would not be a lift home. Novelist Sue Miller reading from her new book, The Story of My Father, a memoir about her father and his struggle and the family's struggle with Alzheimer's. Sue Miller, I wonder about his descent. You describe in that first meeting where he comes to you, the police call, he's disheveled, he's disoriented. You talk him back. Mm-hmm. I mean, you bring him back that time and many times. Mm-hmm. But how did that unfold? Did you begin? Was there a progressive sense that it was harder and harder? Was it in fits and starts? What was the path of his descent?
Well, I think this particular episode pushed him into a sort of state he didn't get into again for a while. He was physically very stressed. He was overtired. He was mm-hmm. hungry. And I think it exposed to us some aspects of the illness, which we weren't going to see again for a while. And that often happens with people, that some form of stress, something bad that happens to them, that reveals their deficiencies in a way that if life goes along calmly and without bumps, you don't see it, perhaps. And life did calm down for a while after this, and he seemed merely to be failing. He was diagnosed fairly shortly after mm-hmm. this, actually. And for a few years, even after his diagnosis, he lived quasi-independently. He was living near my sister then. She had to make arrangements for him all the time and monitor him, make sure he took his medications, call him every day and see him probably, you know, every other day or every third day. But he did manage life on his own. He was able to take walks. He was able to lead a fairly independent life. He had pets. And then, you know, I had signed him up for this continuing care community mm-hmm. near me. Every time an opening arose. The question arose of that. I would be in touch with my sister and say, do you think it's time yet? Mm-hmm. And she would say, he's doing okay. I think not. And then it was time in 1988. And he came east and came to live near me. And his descent from that point on was fairly rapid. His main symptom, actually, was hallucinations and delusions. And that's not always true for people with Alzheimer's disease. There are some people who get by with almost none. And for them, the disease is just a progressive mm-hmm. cognitive loss. Mm-hmm.
So the stop signs as people was a kind of harbinger in that sense.
Exactly. In a continuing way, the main symptom that he showed. He really retained his sense of who people were in his immediate family. Mm. He retained his vocabulary, although he had some trouble with nouns and would make certain substitutions.
But you write that his lifelong kind of charm remained largely intact.
Exactly.
You had some wonderful anecdotes of that.
Well, he just he would greet people. He would make these elaborate sort of circumlocutions mm-hmm. of politeness, mm-hmm. the sorts of speech of politeness. He was always gracious to people in the hallways, and he really remained in some fundamental sense himself.
You are a novelist. You're a close observer of the tiny details. Did you always know when you sat with your father whether he was fully present or whether he was off, whether the Alzheimer's was pulling him away, whether what he was describing, were there moments where you weren't sure whether he was really there with you or not? Was it clear?
There was often a kind of absence in his eyes. But then also, obviously there were times when he was very present, asking something from me and was speaking of something which I knew hadn't happened. My responses to those things were variable. I certainly in this book, I don't model myself as the perfect caregiver in okay. terms of the way I responded, because I responded in very confused ways to his hallucinations and delusions too. Sometimes I discovered fairly early on that how real they were to him, and that if I denied them, it made a barrier between us. So I mm-hmm. stopped denying them. But there were some which I found very difficult to go along with.
Because they were dark? Because they were strange? Because they were just too
demanding,
bizarre,
emotionally. I mean, there was uh-huh. one time when I went in and he said that there had been a fire in the building and children had died. Uh-huh. And he expected my grief. He was indignant because no one around seemed to be grieving
right.
for these children.
Have you no sense of human
yeah.
loss?
And I myself found it I was incapable of
the
performing
theater.
A mm-hmm. grief for him. And I think he found my response to it very alienating. On the other hand, there were delusions that I went along with completely. He had prolonged over some months delusion of wooing and then marrying the woman whom I'd hired to really help him get through each day, to mm-hmm. take walks mm-hmm. with him, to make sure he was dressed nicely, mm-hmm. brush his teeth, that sort of thing. And, of course, she was sharing this very intimate part of his life
yeah.
with him.
Yeah.
And he liked her very much, as did I. And I went in one day and I said, oh, what's new, Dad? And he said, oh, nothing much. And then he said, well, I got married.
Nothing but that.
And I said, oh, that's so nice. Who did you marry? And we sort of talked about how wonderful Marlene was mm-hmm. and then moved on to other subjects. But in that case, I hadn't sort of covered all the bases, because it turned out that he essentially made a pass at her, moved to the very next stage with her, which was sexual. And she liking him as much as she did, handled it very, very well. But she had to report it, and it was a sort of a complication. And I felt very bad and responsible to her that I hadn't, that I'd been so sort of amused and delighted
going
by
along.
My dad's.
But then that's just the difficult terrain here, isn't it? Because this is not a disease that plays out in fevers or tremors. It's in interactions.
Exactly.
This is a human being with a mind that's just awry but working. And you talk about the peculiar emotional potency of Alzheimer's. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it in every family. I mean, the issue is that you're losing someone, as you do in death, but you're losing them over and over and over again. And there's this sort of perpetual sense of loss. And yet, your job as a caregiver, which is sort of a horrible word, but anyway, there it is, is to try to make life enjoyable for this person in spite of all of that in a day-to-day way. I think I also was referring to the sort of sense I had that Alzheimer's disease in my peculiar case was a sort of redoubling of the sense of loss I'd experienced with my father as a little girl, that is, in his abstraction, in his sort of cerebral, in the ether distance from me as well as from my siblings, too, so that it made me feel, it reminded me of that sense that I had of my father as being somewhere else. I tell an anecdote in the story, which he liked to tell in the book, about another theologian who took his daughter Emily for a walk in the University of Chicago campus. And while he was walking her, she was an infant in a carriage, got engaged in a tremendously, to him, fascinating discussion about God and so forth. He returns home and his wife says to him, "But Charles, where's the baby?" And my father liked to tell this story, and this story terrified me because saw myself as they rescued her. She was fine. They lived happily ever after. But this kind of forgetfulness, this sort of abstractedness, this sort of sense of someone to whom these other issues were so enormously important that you just could be essentially abandoned.
But I wondered when I read that whether you were suggesting a kind of root of Alzheimer's that went all the way back to that, or whether Alzheimer's had simply made you aware of a dynamic that you felt a precursor to that wasn't unrelated to the disease, but rather kind of magnified this aspect of your relationship with your dad. And I wonder what your thoughts are, whether this is kind of a typical development when family members deal with Alzheimer's, because strange things are happening. You're kind of off your stride, and do people read into it because it opens up a kind of a vacuum in the middle of the relationship?
I suppose people probably do. I mean, what interested me about some of what I thought I saw in my dad and had seen in him all his life was that possibility, which research looks at in different ways. I mean, you can sort of find a lot of research on one side or the other of this question, but the fact is that some researchers think that if we all lived long enough, we would all succumb to Alzheimer's disease if we didn't die of other things. And some of us would have to live to be 140 or 150 years old before we did, because these plaques and tangles that grow in the brain that accumulate
take longer in some people
might
than
take
others.
Longer, exactly, depending on, I mean, there are all kinds of variables.
But with nearly half having Alzheimer's by 85.
And it just is a line that goes up.
So it sort of suggests that it might wait for us all if we lived long enough.
Yeah. There are people, you know, whose brains they look at who are in their 90s who show virtually no sign of it at all. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, there are people who they've looked at the brains of very young people and found similarly plaques and tangles.
And so?
So the idea is perhaps that that there are people who have had Alzheimer's for a very long time, and their sort of descent into what's recognizably the disease is sort of just the last step. Mm-hmm. And this made me ponder whether or not, you know, some of the things that that I saw as sort of characteristic of my father, quintessentially who he was, might not have been connected to the disease. It made me also wonder about my parents' relationship. My mother was always so driven by my father's distance from her, because she liked to sort of engulf people. Mm-hmm. And his distance from her just kept her coming at him all their married life, kept them in a way very bonded together. And I sort of wondered after the fact if, You know, it was not in some sense his Alzheimer's-ness that she had fallen in love with so passionately and that kept her dancing all of her life.
Keep her working. And at that point, Alzheimer's even, I don't know, as you describe it there, it sounds like almost, I mean, it may have been, could have been an embedded part of his character, almost part of life if it can start so early, so gradually. We have callers who want to join us, Sue Miller. Pat's calling from McGregor, Iowa. Hi, Pat, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My father passed away in November, and he had a combination of Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And about 3 years ago, he started mistaking me, or he thought that I was his brother, his oldest brother, who was killed in World War II. Mm. And they had been very close. And I used to take him out every day, and it was very touching and poignant, I thought.
What kind of things would he say to you, Pat, when he addressed you as his brother?
Oh, he said, wow, wasn't that a great basketball game last night against Waterville and high school things?
Yeah. So he also imagined that you were back in that time, pre-World War II.
Exactly. We were like in 1942.
And did you humor him as Sue Miller did her father when the fantasy seemed harmless enough? Did you go along with it?
Yes, I did. Yes.
I'm nodding because I think that's just so right. And much later, you know, I've sort of talked to people who work with people with Alzheimer's disease. And that's, of course, the prescribed way to behave. There was no sort of received wisdom on this at that time that my father had it. But there's just been tremendous kinds of strides in terms of figuring out how to care for people and also strides in treatment. But one of the things that clearly people feel is that you need to support people in their delusions, that essentially these are things which they do deeply believe. And I think instinctively you did it and I did it too.
Pat, may I ask you, were there times where you, like Sue Miller, found that you just couldn't go along with the fantasy, that it got too difficult, too odd, just a path you couldn't stay on?
No. My father was, he was suffering a lot from Parkinson's, mm-hmm. and it was, I guess whatever I could do to make him a little bit more comfortable, I tried to do. Mm.
Pat, thank you for sharing your story. Sue Miller, the phrase caregiver has come up here, and you write in the book about the, you want to give care, you need to give care, but then you can never give enough, the guilt factor that comes in here.
Yeah, I think it's something that fundamentally drove me to write the book. I think people feel so much as though they would like to make a difference. And our association with caregiving is that it will make a difference somehow. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that this is a progressive disease and it's so painfully progressive. I mean, it's just the person is more and more and more lost to you. And it simply doesn't matter what you do. And I think that's very hard for people. I mean, and the feeling is always, oh, I should be doing more. I should be doing more.
I should be helping.
Yeah, somehow.
We're talking with Sue Miller, novelist and best-selling author of The Good Mother, about Alzheimer's and this true story of her father. Her new book is The Story of My Father, a memoir. You can join the conversation. Have you dealt with the Alzheimer's demise of a loved one? Have you felt the unique despair at a mind, not a body, coming apart? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Sue Miller, novelist and best-selling author of The Good Mother, about Alzheimer's and the story of her father. Her new book is The Story of My Father, a memoir, and it is the story of her father's descent into Alzheimer's and her struggle to be with him, to follow him. Do you hear your story in Sue Miller's words? Is Sue Miller telling the story of your father, your mother, your spouse? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. 5-5. Sue, I wish you'd read us a little more. The book is a delight to read, just as your novels are, but that doesn't mean it's always fun. You describe some difficult things here. There's a passage on 136 I wish you'd take us into.
Okay. One day when I came in, he was agitated. After I'd sat down, he said with some pressure in his voice that he needed to tell Sue something. I said I was Sue. He looked panicked. "Well, yes, I know," he said, "but I meant the other Sue. I need to get in touch with her." "Another Sue? Or Sue Miller?" "No, Sue Miller. I need to tell her something." We went round the confused circle at least once more before I gave up trying to persuade him I was the very person he was thinking of, and suggested he dictate to me whatever he needed to tell Sue, and I would see she got the message. He began with long pauses between nearly every word. "Dear Sue," he said, "I am writing to the one we know as Sue to be in touch." I waited. "So that Sue can hear what I need to tell her." "Which is," I asked, after a long moment, "that I need to be in touch with Sue." And so it went, only the need being announced, never the message, though we sat for 15 minutes or so, and I carefully wrote down each fumbling word. It seemed to me, thinking about it afterward, that what had happened was that his memory of me and the person he saw and recognized as me when I visited him had somehow sheared off from each other. And of course it's true that any person you know well has multiple ways of existing in your mind. The Sues in his brain, I thought, were not all one Sue. Oddly, sadly, I also felt he was getting at something else, a deeper reality in his confusion. For in my treatment of him, I had become another Sue. A caretaker Sue, a cheerful, dismissive Sue. A Sue who, from his perspective, was grossly insensitive to the shocking and astonishing and sometimes painful things that went on daily in his universe. A Sue who had taken his car away from him, who was inattentive when he said he needed, had to have, new glasses, when he told her his books were missing, gone, probably stolen. If he was altered, I thought, so was I. And strangely, in some of the very same ways he was, made bland and callous, reduced by Alzheimer's disease.
Sue Miller, reading from her new book, The Story of My Father, a memoir. I found that a really touching passage, and I wondered as I read it about the relationship. I mean, your father didn't really get hostile or terribly, terribly difficult, but nevertheless, it wasn't your father at a certain point in a certain way. I wondered if you ever felt, looking at this man with a diseased brain, whether this brain in some way, I mean, once the brain goes, what is that person? Did this person become a stranger, even an enemy, in the way that they, here you are describing yourself as reduced by your interaction. Mm-hmm. Was it always the father who you wanted to love, or did it become someone else?
Well, sometimes I felt angry at him. I mean, in the passage in which I'm describing going to pick him up in Western Massachusetts, I remember looking over at him, and he fell asleep in the car on the way home, and he had just been telling me these very alien things, and I remember just looking over at him and thinking, you know, go away, you know, I want my father back. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, you know, this old guy, this geezer made me mad. And there were one or two other encounters we had where I got, you know, really angry at him. Once when we were struggling, the one time we really struggled together physically, I was trying to bring him in from a walk he didn't want to come in from. And I think for those few moments, he truly didn't know who I was. Mm. But he also was terribly frightened towards the end of his life, the last few months, very paranoid, very frightened. And I think it was in part because he was ill and couldn't say that to us and had some pain. And I think he felt he was being attacked. That was his interpretation of his discomfort. Mm-hmm. And he would be very wild, very wound up when I went in. But the fact was that I could always, almost always anyway, find a way to speak to him, to draw him back to something that seemed recognizably my father to me. When he was wildly frightened and paranoid and angry, I could often read him the Bible or sing hymns to him. And just that, clearly those passages in his brain were so familiar, so deeply embedded that
soothed
him. They calmed him, yeah.
Denise is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Denise. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. I had a question for Sue.
Mm-hmm.
Both of my grandparents and my great-aunt suffered from Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to watch, but it's also, you know, it's a little scary. At least it was for me, because one of the questions that you can't help but ask yourself as you're trying to help people understand this is this what the future has in store for you?
Sure. I think, you know, that there is that fear we have, and there clearly are some profoundly genetic components to Alzheimer's disease, and they're finding more genes all the time that that have some predictable relation to it. But I think there are also, I mean, in my own case, I think if I thought I were symptomatic at all, I would certainly go and try to be tested right away, because there are drugs now which can at least slow the progress of the disease.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I also take some comfort in looking at others in my family who lived into their, well into their 90s without showing any symptoms. And I think it's important. Also, the fact is that timing is almost everything with this disease.
Meaning,
I
mean, what?
Meaning, if you get it when you're 90, the chances are very good, if you're just starting to be symptomatic, mm-hmm. that you're going to die of something else before you die from this disease, and the disease will not be very advanced by the time you do die. If you get it when you're as young as my father, it's a very different story. And I'm, even though, you know, I think I stand a better chance than most of getting it because of this slightly, you know, inherited risk.
Genetic factor.
I am trying to be optimistic at this point.
Denise, do you find yourself worrying when you can't find the car keys?
Well, I do. Mm-hmm. I do. And, you know, on one side of my family, there is a history of Alzheimer's. And on the other side of my family, there is a history of longevity with no types of problems at all. So,
isn't life, you know, grand? You don't know what card you're going to be dealt.
No, you don't. And
but there's also the car accident, you know. I mean,
right,
it does
right.
seem to
well,
me
nothing,
that it's...
Right. Nothing is promised to us, of course. But, you know, it does seem to be such a cruel disease because it robs people of what really is the essence of them.
Yes, exactly.
Their memories of them, their memories of us, those things that we share that really help to make us a family.
Denise, thank you for calling. Sue Miller, at the end of the day, you went through what many people go through with relatives here. But in your case, how did it leave you revising your understanding of your father, of your relationship with him, of how you think about yourself?
Well, I think that in a certain way, I mean, I talk in the book about revising the book, and I think the revising of the book genuinely led to a sort of revision of my father. That is to say, I felt I learned about him even after his death. And that,
by pondering all that had happened during the disease and before?
Exactly. And by trying to make this book, essentially, and writing about him and sort of looking at his life anew and looking at it very carefully, I was very bitter after his death and very angry about the way he had died. And I think that in sort of pondering his life, it was as though, you know, his life spoke to me in a way, and I felt I learned from him a different way of thinking about things as I wrote this book. I mean, it made me think of the, you know, the way in which when we're writing fiction, we try to essentially reproduce, or I do, the sort of sense we have of the open-endedness of truth. And I felt as though that's what I was experiencing as I wrote this book, that I could revise my father. I could probably revise him again if I thought about it hard enough. But there's a way in which the truth keeps informing us, and that goes on, you know, that is our connection to those people that we love who have died, is that the truth is very open-ended. It's endlessly open-ended, I think.
Novelist Sue Miller, her new book is The Story of My Father, a memoir. Sue Miller, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, writer Alice Furlow on the unreality of television. This is On Point. Writer Alice Furlow admits she rarely watches TV because her elderly cat, Miss Pudding, dislikes it. But lately she's found herself watching quite a bit and wondering if she, and all of us viewers, have been getting the true picture from television.
Any day now, a docudrama about the rescue of Private First Class Jessica Lynch from imprisonment in an Iraqi hospital will probably arrive on our television screens. Jessica was briefly filmed on a stretcher being loaded onto a plane. But that moment was too brief to satisfy American viewers' sense of entitlement. We need to witness on our screens Jessica's entire ordeal and lots more about her. So, except in that actual picture on the stretcher, Jessica will be played by an actress, or maybe two or three actresses, if, as I've heard, there are several docudramas in the works. In 1992, I saw three actresses playing Princess Diana, as well as three Fergies, a couple of Prince Charleses, and a few Queen Elizabeths in several docudramas about the Prince and Princess of Wales's glamorous, miserable marriage. In at least one of them, we saw the real royal couple at the altar and being driven through the real cheering wedding crowds. Then we saw Charles and Di making love, played by actors. Some viewers could be excused for thinking they remember the real Princess Diana in bed with the prince. But it's not just dramatizations of celebrities' lives that are loosening our national grip on reality. I was glad when Ted Koppel, embedded with some division or other in Iraq, introduced viewers to his crew with all their camera equipment and satellite telephones and things. We needed reminders of the incredible complex technology that brought us all those films of soldiers and Marines in camouflage battle dress, and there were precious few of those reminders. With Operation Iraqi Freedom on television 24 hours a day, your TV set became a window in your house from which you could look out on the war whenever you wanted to, day and night. By now, I bet a lot of Americans are convinced they have an inalienable right to witness effortlessly all the sorrows and joys and horrors of the world, from the sobbing parents of murdered high school students to the toppling of tyrant statues. But saturated as we are with world events, I don't believe we are getting the true picture. I don't mean just the war footage, which made us familiar with M1 Abrams tanks and AH-1W Super Cobra helicopters, but didn't show us screaming or bleeding wounded civilians. I mean that so much of the world is televised for us that soon, perhaps, anything that isn't televised will seem unimportant. One summer, I was reporting on a Maine church supper for the New York Times. Three or four women who were making squash casseroles and baked beans told me about the bicentennial celebration which had just happened in their tiny town. It sounded lovely. They all wore their great-grandmother's bonnets and paraded through town in horse-drawn buggies. But to all those women, the day was a terrible disappointment. Because, as one of them explained sadly, it wasn't on television. To her, without huge cameras filming away on Main Street, it was almost as if the festival hadn't happened at all. Watching television these days, I keep thinking of Plato's analogy for the unenlightened mind, people living all their lives chained inside a cave so that all they can see is the shadows cast by the fire onto the opposite wall. Would they not assume, asks Plato, that the shadows they saw were real things? If Plato could come into an American living room during Dateline or 48 Hours or the Jessica Lynch drama, I wonder if he'd think his cave fantasy had come true.
Alice Furlow is a writer and NPR contributor. She lives on Cape Cod, Massachusetts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.